Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Science and technology make complex criminal investigations much easier than they used to be. Think DNA, fingerprinting, CSI. But how did investigators solve cases before science played such an important role? That's the very question that inspired Boston author Doug Starr to write his latest book. Starr was poring through medical journals when he came across the case of a 19th century serial killer named Joseph Vacher and the scientist who helped bring him to justice, Dr. Alexander Lacassagne. In his latest book, called The Killer of Little Shepherds, Starr focuses on these two characters. One embodies pure evil, the other is committed to advancing forensic science. The book begins with what seems like an innocent encounter. Doug Starr and I decided to read the first few paragraphs.
On a drizzly spring evening in 1893, in the French provincial city of Besançon, 19-year-old Louise Baron was walking along the riverside promenade when she crossed paths with a man wearing the dress uniform of the French army. His name was Joseph Vacher. "Ugly weather, isn't it?" he said, and automatically she responded, "For sure."
Normally, Barant would not have spoken to a stranger, especially one as brutish as he. But Vacher projected a kind of disarming innocence, and the sergeant's chevrons on his sleeves reassured her.
So they chatted and walked and shared dinner in a café. They learned that they both came from small towns, and as they lingered over shared stories about their pasts, he told her that he had never felt comfortable this way with anyone, and she too sensed she could speak freely and easily. Yet she felt a shiver of doubt when she looked up from her meal and saw his eyes burning into her. Later that evening, he ardently proposed marriage. When he vowed that he would kill her if she ever betrayed him, she realized she had made a terrible mistake.
So, Doug Starr, why was that a terrible mistake for Louise Barant?
Well, she didn't know it, but she had been taking a stroll and having dinner with a guy who turned out to be a psychopath. He became somewhat obsessed with her, and over the weeks and months that followed, she tried to fend him off. He tried to kill anyone that came near her. She moved back to her home village, and he showed up there one day, vowing to take her away.
And didn't kill her, but seriously injured her.
Something really bad happened. Yes. he tracked her down and confronted her and shot her in the head and shot himself in the head. Both survived. He was shipped off to a mental asylum, and that was the beginning of his infamous career.
So he was a notorious serial killer of the 1800s. Most people think about Jack the Ripper, but this guy, Vacher, was more of a killer than Jack the Ripper.
Well, statistically speaking, he was more than twice as bad when you think of it. Jack the Ripper killed 5 prostitutes in a particular neighborhood of London. Vacher confessed to 11 killings. He may have killed 20 or 25 all over vast regions of France. He was about 10 years after Jack the Ripper, and he became known as the Ripper of France.
So Vacher is a key character in your book. So was someone whose last name is Lacassagne.
Right.
But he's an investigator.
Right. Dr. Alexandre Lacassagne was the most famous criminal scientist of his time. Now, this time, the 1880s and 90s, was really when modern forensics was born. There was a coterie of people in Europe, not too much in England. They were far behind. In America, unfortunately, was quite far behind. They were scientists and physicians and some lawyers. And they were the people who devised the techniques that became known as forensic science. And Lacassagne was the first among equals. He was based out of Lyon.
Forensic science basically meaning crime scene analysis.
Yeah, I mean, what they call CSI, what they look at on TV today, although that's really a fiction.
And Doug Starr, I'd like you to tell us about some of that forensic science from the 1800s by telling us about one of the cases that Lacassagne solved. Would you do that by first reading at the top of Chapter 10?
Yes. One of Lacassagne's treasured artifacts was the skeleton of a young man hanging in a display case, its head reattached after an encounter with the guillotine. On the inner surface of the right pelvis, the name Gomez was inscribed in inch-high letters. It served as a reminder of brutal crime and the power of science to use even the tiniest traces of evidence to solve it.
And La Cassagna did use a tiny trace of evidence to solve this.
Tiny and in a place you wouldn't expect to find it.
Do you want to tell us about that?
This young man, Anne Gomez, was a hardened criminal by the age of 24. He had many convictions, many encounters with the police. And one night he and his gang brutally murdered a cafe owner upstairs in her apartment. They crushed in her head with a bottle. There were no clues to be had. La Cassagna and his crew came in the next day. There was the usual blood spatter evidence, which they learned to analyze by distance and direction and shape of the spatters. There was the bottle, but no useful prints on it. They collected everything they could. And the one thing that was very unusual they found was, sorry to have to say this, a pile of human excrement. And sometimes criminals do strange things at the crime scene. La Cassagna, being very meticulous, collected this pile, and back at the lab, among other things, he dissolved it in water and noticed some tiny, tiny barely microscopic squiggles. And he brought in a colleague, an entomologist, who identified it as pinworms, which was a fairly common parasite at the time. Meanwhile, the police had hauled in the usual suspects, and La Cassagna went to the jail and took samples from these people.
Excrement samples.
Well, the excrement was contaminated because it had gone into waste buckets with other stuff, so he had to take samples directly from the people. You don't need more details than that, do you?
I think you get the picture.
Yeah. So he took samples, and in the sample from Gomez, they found some tiny pinworm eggs. And what happened in those days was sometimes confronted with the evidence, the suspect would confess.
So the fact that there was evidence on the scene that contained pinworms and that this suspect had pinworms connect the two.
He connected the two. It had never been done before, this kind of thing. Gomez was flabbergasted. He went to trial. He was sent to the guillotine. And here was a hard case. He had no love for or admiration for anyone. But on the way to the guillotine, he stopped them. He said, you know what? That doctor who figured this out, he's a smart guy. After this is over, you could give him my body as a gift. So that skeleton, the head reattached, now hangs in Dr. La Cassagna's laboratory.
Before we get to the larger picture, the fact that he connected pinworms at the scene with a suspect with pinworms, I would think pinworms were a very common malady at the time. How do we know that just because they found someone with pinworms, he was the guy that did the crime?
Well, he was one of the six suspects. He was a known suspect, and he was the only one with the pinworm eggs, and it led to his confession. You know, what these guys did was not perfect by 21st century standards, but by turn of the century standards, it was absolutely brilliant.
The title of the chapter that you just read from, Chapter 10, is Never Without a Trace. And that's a very meaningful chapter title because it gets at the idea that no matter how careful the criminal, no matter how much they think they clean up after they leave, they either leave evidence behind or they take evidence with them.
Yeah, and this was a concept. One of La Cassagna's famous students was named Edmond Locard, and he enunciated what became known as the Locard exchange principle, which means something always gets exchanged, and people still basically believe that. And these people were the pioneers in, you know, footprints. It was before fingerprints, but they looked for other traces. Fibers, hairs. They were the first to analyze the difference of hairs of the different races and different parts of the body. There was always some little trace.
You write about evidence left in cuffs or hat linings,
dust. Don't forget, it was also the golden age of the optical microscope. And the microscopes produced by Zeiss at the time were as powerful as anything before the electron microscope. So these people learned to see things that previously were invisible.
So you write about this emerging field of modern criminology. Suddenly people were creating databases of maps and statistics to track murders. They were performing medical autopsies, which was new. Before all this, how primitive was the process of collecting crime scene evidence?
It wasn't awful. They did a bit of it, but mostly what they did was they would grab suspects and either torture them or intimidate them into confessing. The famous Inspector Vidocq, who was the model for many inspectors since then in fiction, would insinuate people into criminal gangs and entrap people. But what La Cassagna and his colleagues found was that frequently people lied. Either witnesses lied on purpose to settle a grudge, or their memories were faulty, and they turned to what they called the silent witnesses, which meant evidence at the scene. And they used the evidence to recreate crime scenes, and this was one of their big contributions.
So let's go back to those two people that we talked about, Vache and La Cassagna, because one is a criminal, one is an investigator. This is the 1800s. Eventually, their paths meet.
They do. They do. Vache was your classic psychopath. From an early age, he was abusive to his peers. He also had religious obsessions, and he went to a monastery for a couple of years. Like many sociopaths, he could be charming when he needed to and then turn brutal. He was very clever. He would kill children. He mostly stalked children. And the reason the book is called The Killer of Little Shepherds is because what better place to find a child without any witnesses nearby than to find a shepherd in the middle of the countryside? And that's what he did. After he killed, he would walk 20 miles to get into the next district, knowing that communication was bad. He was literate. He gave handwriting lessons and math lessons to some of the farm families he stayed with. And he was self-pitying, and that was him. On the other hand, here was Lacassagne.
The investigator.
The investigator, a medical doctor, you know, trained in medicine, did world-famous studies, a real Renaissance man. In addition to studying criminal behavior, he studied industrial hygiene before it was fashionable. He was a connoisseur of the arts. He had an enormous coterie of students and other people that he helped. He also felt compassion for the criminals. Once a week, every Sunday, he walked across town to the St. Paul prison in Lyon and would speak with criminals and have them write their diaries. And so these were two opposite guys.
And at what point did Lacassagne, the investigator, get involved with Vache, the criminal?
Well, Vache eventually got caught because he slipped up during an attempted rape and murder, and the villagers caught him. And then a brilliant small-town investigator named Emile Fouquet had been doing some profiling work, and he figured out who it was. And soon after getting caught, Vache tried to act insane. And he really made a convincing case. And at this point, after weeks and weeks of interrogation, Emile Fouquet telegraphed Dr. Lacassagne and said, "This is somebody who I cannot, you know, he's more than my equal. We need you to come here." And then Lacassagne spent more than 5 months talking to Vache and trying to analyze what he did in order to figure out whether he was insane or not.
In the book, you talk about the emergence of medical autopsies, which are different than hospital autopsies. And I want to read part of it, and I should warn listeners that some of this is hard to hear. You write, "The body is little more than shapeless clumps of organs and flesh and odd tufts of hair clinging to a bone structure. The stench is even worse than the appearance. It is a mixture of every repulsive odor in the world, excrement, rotted meat, swamp water, urine, and it invades the sinuses by full frontal assault." This sounds like something written by a man who has seen and smelled this.
Yes. The case that made Lacassagne world famous was called the Case of the Bloody Trunk. Gouffet was a bailiff in Paris, a widower, well known for his sexual adventures and his wealth, and a couple of thieves, a woman and a man, conspired to lure him into a room. She lured him into a room where his confederate strangled Gouffet before he could react. They found to their horror he wasn't carrying any money, so they put his body in a trunk, took the overnight train with it to Lyon, rented a carriage, went south of Lyon and dumped it down a hill, expecting it to roll into the Rhone River and be washed into the Mediterranean. The trunk got hung up in some bushes, and a medical examiner did an autopsy, and neither he nor Gouffet's relatives could identify the body, because even by then it was a bit old. So the body got buried, and several months later, an investigator in Paris, the famous Monsieur Garon, got some clues and contacted Lacassagne, and he said, "I want you to take another look at this case." So there was the bloody trunk. It was dug up again, and Lacassagne did an autopsy with the most amazing precision, looking for little nonconformities in the bone, little discolorations. And by doing this over a period of days and contacting doctors in Paris, he was able to narrow down exactly who this guy was. And it was astonishing. I mean, he said, "This guy looks like this. He has a limp. He probably has gout. I suspect that one of his shoes is designed differently than the other to accommodate the limp."
And how was he concluding this? He was seen
simply by tiny deformities in the bone. You know, exactly how big this guy was, where the bones were rubbing the wrong way, what his tooth pattern was. And it led to the conviction of the murders, and it made him an international sensation.
Was there something about that man's hair that also stood out?
The other thing, too, was that I believe he had chestnut hair, and everybody was fooled because the hair was black. But in the course of putrefaction, hair will turn black. And Lacassagne cleaned the hair off and sent samples to his partner in the hospital and found out that it was chestnut and it was identifiable. I have all the original notes, all the original autopsy reports, and a believer in nonfiction as I am, I thought something was missing, and that is the visceral sense of what this is. So over the course of my research, I became friendly with the current director of the Institute of Legal Medicine that Lacassagne founded in Lyon, and I asked him if I could ever sit in on some criminal autopsies, and he said, I'll give you a call if something turns up. So I sat in on a couple, one of which was a very old putrefied body. So yeah, this is first-hand accounting.
You also talk about how it's very, very important to do medical autopsies with care and precision, because if you bungle them, for example, if you hammer open a skull, as you put, rather than very carefully surgically open it, you eliminate any chance of seeing if there had been head trauma. So this was very important.
It was, and one of the things Lacassagne did was he set up something called observational papers, in which there were a series of questions and a series of forms to fill out. So even a country doctor who was performing an autopsy on a kitchen table, which was fairly typical, could do it correctly.
You talked about when you do an autopsy, you can realize, for example, that if there are tiny furrows around someone's neck, it means they've been hung. Or if there are little breakpoints on the side of the larynx, it means you may have been strangled. So it's subtle things, but they make the difference between a natural death and an intentional death.
Yes, this was terribly important. At the time, you know, a body was found and people don't know how it died or why the person died. And Lacassagne and his colleagues did enormous studies. They worked for years studying how people were killed. He had a criminal museum in which plaster facsimiles of dead bodies or preserved dead bodies were displayed next to the weapons that killed him so that other investigators could come in and match up the cause and effect. He was the guy that figured out that certain bullets could be matched to certain guns by the patterns in the bullets. So it was all this idea of using evidence from the scene to recreate the last moments of what happened. They also worked with timing, because one of the fascinating things that he understood was that death isn't an endpoint, it's a turning point. And that as soon as the body dies, all of the resistance stops, all of the blood flow stops, and it becomes a medium for bacteria and insects. So he and his colleagues started to work forward, okay, which insects settle at which time, and they started developing sort of a clock.
You mentioned earlier that there was a growing belief at the time that some people were born criminals, that you were biologically predestined to be a killer in some cases. What were some of the things about people's biology that would be a giveaway that you were destined to kill?
Yeah, I mean, it was said to stem from a certain part of the brain that wasn't properly developed, and this led to certain physical features. I mean, the famous one was the unibrow and the ears that stick out and the lantern jaw. One of the interesting things that I found was the novel Dracula was written in 1897, right at the height of all this, and Dracula was designed to resemble the criminal man. So he wasn't the smooth, you know, pretty guy that you see on vampire movies. He was a bit of a thug. You know, he had pointy ears and a unibrow, and this was the model. Actually, Darwin's cousin, Dalton, made a kind of field guide to criminals, as though we might have a field guide to birds, showing this is the prototypical thief, this is the prototypical killer, this is the prototypical rapist. So this idea was really quite popular.
Lacassagne rejected that idea.
He did. He was an early adherent to it, but he did a lot of statistical studies and what we now would call epidemiological studies, and he would do enormous charts correlating growing season and economic conditions to crime, family conditions to crime, and he became famous for opposing the born criminal theory. He really believed it was the circumstances in which you grew up.
Your family, your environment, society.
Yeah, seasons.
Where does that science stand now? Do some people still believe you can be predisposed to be brutal?
Well, the science, or what we would call the science, never died. I mean, after this, there was the famous Juke family studies, in which scientists studied a family of alleged criminals and you know, lame brain people, for want of a better word. And it turned out that, you know, they selectively picked the family members. There were the Kallikak studies, same thing. You may remember from the 1960s the famous XYY studies, showing that people with an extra Y chromosome are like hyper male and more inclined to commit crimes. People have never stopped wanting to be able to kind of pick the criminal species and declare they're the other and therefore easier to segregate.
So Lacassagne was an investigator who was a pioneer of criminal forensics in the 1800s. What do you think he would think of modern-day forensics?
Let me turn that around. I was talking to a medical examiner a couple of weeks ago, and she said, I wish this guy had been my boss. These guys were great. And I was talking to a neurologist about the frontiers of neurology, because right now a few people, are doing brain scans of psychotics to find out what's going on neurologically. And he said something very similar. He said, you know, these guys were brilliant. They may not have had the technology, but they were every bit as smart as we are. Now, what would Lekasanya think of what's going on now? That's a very interesting question. Of course, he would love the technology. I think one thing he would disapprove is that in America, almost all of the crime labs are administratively part of the police departments, and he didn't believe in that. He believed in something that's called the observer effect or observer bias, in which if your salary comes from the police department, even if you're a civilian, you may be subconsciously tempted to give them the results that they, quote, want. And that's been happening in recent years, and it's become something of a scandal. Whereas Lekasanya decided Gribbenow Labs always to be part of a university or a scientific institute. And the other thing he always said, I think he would really laugh at some of these CSI shows, because his investigations took a long time, and he, for that matter, he laughed at Sherlock Holmes, because his motto was, one must always know how to doubt. And these criminologists who sort of get their notion and figure it out with certainty would not appeal to him at all. To the very end, he would say, okay, but could there be another explanation? He was a real scientist.
Do you think that based on the reporting you've done on criminal forensics in the 1800s up to now, that what we see on shows like the CSI shows are an accurate depiction of what happens in forensic crime labs?
No, not at all. It's funny because there's something called the CSI effect, known in legal circles, in which they say jurors' expectations of forensic work have become so unrealistic that it's hard to turn in a fair verdict if there's any doubt whatsoever. Most labs don't have that technology. Most labs have long backups of cases. A lot of labs have had scandals about people who are not really precise about their results. So it's nice that we have these dramas on TV and can enjoy them, but they are not to be taken as fact.
Could you just talk very briefly about what the process was like researching something that happened in the 1800s, where certainly the people are dead, and in many cases the records are non-existent or not very good?
Yeah, as a journalist, there was a certain amount of frustration because I couldn't pick up the phone and call one of these people. But it took 4 years of research. I got everything written. I went to the courthouse where the trial took place, where there were thousands and thousands of pages of handwritten testimony, and spent several days with a digital camera photographing every document. There's a whole wing of the library in Lyon dedicated to Lekasanya with all of his case records. I spent the equivalent of weeks and weeks there. I went to the villages where the murders took place after getting all the original autopsy reports, and sought out the village elders and asked them what traditional life was like and what their grandparents may have told them. As you may have guessed, I speak the language. As you know, I went to the Institute of Medicine and observed autopsies, and I was able to find Lekasanya's descendants. His great-granddaughter is a judge, and his great-grandson is a doctor, and they too had crates of very interesting artifacts left over that gave me an insight into his personality.
Like what kinds of things?
Well, the best thing, he had an offbeat sense of humor. And like many criminologists at the time, he did a lot of studies of tattoos because the prisoners' tattoos revealed something about their culture. He called them speaking scars. But what he also did, he had many of the tattoos reproduced on the family's dinnerware. So some guest might be over for dinner and getting to the bottom of his beef bourguignon, only to see written on his plate, death to French authorities. I thought that gave an insight into the guy.
You wrote a previous book called Blood that was about how human blood became a commodity, basically. So your interest seems very much to be the intersection of science and justice, really.
Very much so. I like the idea of science as a lens through which to view the human endeavor. Someone else might see art that way, but I find fascinating the kind of sciences that bridge several disciplines and tell us a little bit more about ourselves and the way we live.
Doug Starr, thanks for coming on Radio Boston.
A pleasure.
To read an excerpt from Doug Starr's new book called The Killer of Little Shepherds, A True Crime Story and the Birth of Forensic Science, and to see pictures from the book, visit our website, wbur.org/Boston. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.